Thanks for tuning in for the December 14th podcast. I'm Jose Merino, Editor-in-Chief of the Neurology family of journals. In our What's Trending segment, Dr. Zachary Greenspan talks about the comparative effectiveness of ACTH, oral steroids, vigabatrine, and non-standard therapies for children with infantile spasms. This week's feature interviews with Dr. Ricardo Taipa and focuses on the clinical manifestations, imaging results, and neuropathological findings in patients who have hereditary transthyretin amyloidosis with CNS involvement.
Hello, this is Hallie Alexander with the Neurology Podcast. Today I'm speaking with Zachary Greenspan, a pediatric epileptologist at Cornell. We're going to talk about the article, Comparative Effectiveness of Initial Treatment for Infantile Spasms in a Contemporary U.S. Cohort. In this study, Dr. Greenspan and his team analyzed the Neonatal Infantile Spasms Consortium Registry to evaluate the effectiveness of different treatments for infantile spasms using this prospective, multicenter observational dataset. Zach, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, this is not the first study that's been done comparing first-line treatments for infantile spasms. In fact, I'll refer our listeners to a previously recorded episode from December 5th, 2017, where Ted Burns interviews John Meidinger regarding a trial of ACTH versus prednisolone. But for today, of course, we'll focus on the current study. So, Zach, tell us, what is unique about this study compared to previous studies of the different treatments for infantile spasms?
Great question. So this study, in many ways, is a remarkable snapshot of how American pediatric epilepsy experts have taken care of children with infantile spasms for the past decade. We collected data from 2012 through 2018 at 23 centers. These centers were part of the Pediatric Epilepsy Research Consortium. In the particular study, we called this the National Infantile Spasms Consortium to collect these data. And the data were collected in an observational way. And so there was no specific intervention. We just asked our colleagues around the country to enter information into a database about who they were seeing, who they were treating for infantile spasms, what they did, and what the outcomes were. So as a result, it's a huge collection of patients. It's 629 children in the database when we analyzed it. What makes it unique then is you know, number one, the size. Then number two, we used a lot of modern statistical machinery to try to recreate a clinical trial as if we had done it. When you're doing observational data, you can't randomize, you can't tell people what to do, but you can do some tricks that allow you to imagine and account for different kinds of biases that come into play that may impact decision-making, that may impact outcomes, and then approximate what might have happened had this been a clinical trial. And so our findings were interesting because they showed a couple of things. First, they showed that the outcomes from the two hormonal first-line therapies, ACTH and oral prednisolone, were roughly the same. There's been some prior data that suggests that ACTH is better. And then there are conflicting reports that say, well, maybe they're the same, and even some that say that oral steroids are better. And what we found is that the point estimates of the effects were almost the same. And most of our sensitivity analyses agreed with that. So that was reassuring to many of us in the field who have developed the habit, developed the practice of using oral steroids as first-line therapy. The second thing it found was that anything other than first-line therapy, i.e. first-line therapy being ACTH, oral prednisolone, or vigabatrin, that using something different than those three doesn't work. There have been some patterns of care where things like topiramate, the ketogenic diet, zonisamide, benzodiazepines, and other kinds of treatment have been used first-line, and the outcomes in the group that did not get one of the first-line therapies were really poor. And so I think that the main lessons of the paper are that we do have reasonable choices in what we want to use to treat infantile spasms as first-line, but that we have to pick from the three recommended therapies.
Great. Thank you so much for explaining that. So this is basically looking at real world data outside of a clinical trial. And now I know the audience and, you know, many people that treat infantile spasms are wondering whether this is finally an answer to whether ACTH or oral steroids is a more effective treatment. And it sounds like from your answer, this is saying, at least in this study, that they appeared to be about the same.
That's exactly right. There was one sub-analysis that suggested a slight benefit of ACTH, but most of our sub-analyses suggested that oral steroids and ACTH gave essentially identical outcomes. And this is important for so many reasons. Many of us in our heart of hearts believe ACTH is better based on clinical experience, but there are many others of us that use oral steroids because it's less expensive, it's easier to get, it's better tolerated, there are fewer side effects. And so the study doesn't definitively point to one as better than the other, but it gives us reassurance that we can be comfortable in our clinical decisions as a field and recognize that whichever one we choose, as long as we choose one of them, we're going to get the best outcomes, that the evidence suggests that the best outcomes are going to be from choosing one of those drugs and not something else.
And you bring up a good point there that, you know, it's not just choosing the most effective drug always. It also impacts your decision, what the side effects of the drugs might be, you know, that particular patient's comorbidities, cost of the drug, mode of delivery. So there are some differences between these two medications in those realms. But one of the things that really stands out between these two medications, like you mentioned, is the cost. So do you know what is the, you know, roughly the difference in the list price between these two drugs?
There's a dramatic difference in the price. You're absolutely right. Oral steroids, it's relatively inexpensive. I don't have that information in front of me, but it's, you know, a few dollars, tens of dollars, maybe a few hundred dollars. Whereas with ACTH, we're talking tens of thousands, if not $100,000 for a course of therapy. And then there are other differences, just thinking with the hormonal therapies. Oral steroids are oral. It's a liquid. It's often well-tolerated. Side effects with both hormonal therapies include things like weight gain, irritability, trouble sleeping. With ACTH, the medicine has to be given as an injection. And so there's the added burden on the families of having to give an injection to the child's thigh, typically twice a day during the course of treatment. When the COVID-19 pandemic hit, many of us in the field were very concerned about infantile spasms and how are we going to take care of this population. And based on this data, at the time it was preliminary, it was before the paper came out, but based on the data and the analysis we had done that led to this manuscript, we actually worked, the Pediatric Epilepsy Research Consortium worked with the Child Neurology Society to release a statement essentially saying that during the pandemic, there was a soft preference for oral steroids because it would allow us to keep kids out of the hospital, allow us to get medications from commercial pharmacies, from retail pharmacies, rather than having to do the special orders for the ACTH. And so we made that argument and published it both online and then later in a couple of papers.
Well, that was very timely that you had this information at your fingertips, you know, during that crisis to be able to treat people appropriately. So have your personal preferences for the way that you treat infantile spasms changed based on the results of this study?
It's such a good question. Old habits die hard. And before we did this analysis, I remember a child who we started oral steroids because the child came in through emergency department and we wanted to get something started. And then in the light of day, we switched over to ACTH because many of us, based on the older literature, felt that the evidence suggested it was better. I think in that, if I was faced in that situation now, thinking about that patient, I would have just continued the oral steroids. It had been working. And we know now from this paper that we have good confidence the outcomes are similar. So just to answer the question, I think the key way that my practice has changed from this paper is that my comfort in using oral steroids for first line is really, really increased. And in those conversations you have with a family where you're going through the different options and you're weighing them with the families, talking about risks and benefits, talking about the outcomes and the evidence that supports these decisions, the language I use in those conversations is going to be much more favorable to oral steroids than it was in the past. I used to cite older literature saying that ACTH was better, and I won't do that anymore. I'll be much more balanced based on these findings. I don't think the question's totally settled. This paper strengthens the argument that they're both very good and that they're both reasonable choices. But reasonable people and informed people that know the literature could make the argument that there is still a case that the outcomes are better with ACTH. And so it's a justified treatment in those cases. We have to be careful in interpreting the literature about how strongly we make recommendations, because specifically with that price difference, many of us, if we believe that the balance of the evidence favors ACTH, we need to have comfort that if we select that based on our clinical judgment and based on our own understanding of literature, that it's better, that we don't want to be in a situation where an insurance company or a payer rejects that. And so I think that there's a distinction between what we've said here, which is we've looked at this one set of data, and in this observational cohort using observational methods, we're seeing similar outcomes. But that observation, that research finding, is not by itself enough to say, well, then these are interchangeable therapies. And there's other evidence to be brought to bear that require meta-analyses and other consensus techniques to integrate all of the evidence that's out there. And so what you're hearing from me is sort of a struggle to say, look, this particular research is suggesting that the outcomes are pretty similar, but this isn't the last word, and that my colleagues and I should have the ability to make choices based on a synthesis of the entirety of the literature as well as our own clinical experience.
Do you think this, you know, perfect study of a randomized controlled trial of these two medications will ever be done?
No, I can't imagine that study would be done, in part because there's so many important questions around infantile spasms care that we don't know. There's some literature that's starting to think about using combination therapy, and sorting that out is going to require some work and some trials. When spasms remit, when the first line therapy works, we don't know how to prevent relapse. 40% of kids who have infantile spasms that respond and that the spasms go away, 40% of them, the spasms recur. And we don't know if we can prevent that. If the first line therapy fails, then we're not sure what to do next. We have one paper that says, well, if you use hormonal therapy, switched over to vigabatrin. If you start with vigabatrin, switch over to hormonal therapy. But that's only one paper, and it hasn't been fleshed out. And that analysis hasn't been done on the full cohort. You know, the role of etiology, the role of the cause of infantile spasms, and which drug to choose isn't worked out either. We know that for tuberous sclerosis, that kids with tuberous sclerosis often respond very well to vigabatrin. And so that's really the one exception where you might prefer vigabatrin as your first line therapy. But we don't know if there's others. You talk to people and everyone has their case history and their anecdote about one thing working better for this or for that. But that evidence really hasn't been firmed up. So given that there's so many unanswered questions, and that the question of ACTH versus oral steroids doesn't feel that pressing because they're probably roughly the same, makes me think that we're probably going to try to answer some of these other questions before we return to that first question.
I see. Well, thank you so much for your time today. Again, I've been speaking with Zachary Grinspan regarding his recent article in Neurology titled Comparative Effectiveness of Initial Treatment for Infantile Spasms in a Contemporary U.S. Cohort. Zach, thank you again for your efforts in this research and for joining us on the podcast today.
Thank you so much.
Hello, this is Gordon Smith. I'm a professor and chair of neurology at Virginia Commonwealth University, and I'm extremely pleased to have the opportunity to talk with Cardo Taipa about his really fascinating article, CNS Involvement in Hereditary Transthyretin Amyloidosis. You know, most of us think about hereditary amyloidosis as a peripheral nervous system disorder. I'm a neuromuscular guy, so that's certainly where I spend most of my time. So perhaps you can start by explaining why CNS involvement in amyloidosis is something we should be looking for and why this is such an important issue for us today.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. This is the, as you know, this the two most prominent manifestations of hereditary amyloidosis, ATTR, is the polyneuropathy and cardiomyopathy. And that was the major issue until the, I would say, the last 20 years or so. But with the advances in treatment, first with the liver transplantation, and we start seeing that after the liver transplantation, but now more recently with these new medical drugs for treating the disorder, we start seeing CNS symptoms in these patients. And it seems like the condition was too severe and the life expectancy was too short for them to develop the CNS symptoms, because we already knew from the first descriptions of the disorder that in post-mortem patients that CNS was involved. But it seems like the patient didn't have time to develop these clinical symptoms because unfortunately they died before that happened. But now, and fortunately, this is becoming a non-fatal disorder, and progressively the patients are having more of these symptoms. And basically it's because the treatments that we have doesn't seem to affect the progression of the disorder in CNS and in the eye. What we are looking is that the shifting of the phenotype spectrum, because we are reshaping the disorder at the peripheral level, but the disease seems to be progressing in the CNS compartment.
So you talk about this in the article. Why is it that the CNS compartment is not adequately treated with the available therapies that we have?
You know that 90% of the protein is produced by the liver, but it keeps producing in the choroid plexus and some pigmentum of the retina. And with liver transplant, we abolish the production of the mutated protein, but it keeps producing the mutated protein in the CNS compartment. The new compounds, or they are too large to cross the blood-brain barrier, or they just reach the CSF in the very low concentrations.
One of the things that I found particularly interesting, and I think might prove challenging in recognizing and treating this disorder, is the broad spectrum of CNS manifestations that you can see in these patients. Could you briefly describe the phenotypic spectrum of this disorder?
Yeah, as you said, we have a really broad spectrum of clinical symptoms. The most common is also known as amyloid spells, what we call transient focal neurological episodes, and also some cerebrovascular events like ischemic stroke, intercerebral lobar hemorrhages or subarachnoid hemorrhages, but also things like cranial nerve dysfunction, hearing loss, and other cranial nerve dysfunction associated with it, and also cognitive decline.
I would love to learn more about the TFNEs, the transient focal neurological episodes, or amyloid spells that patients experience. You know, can you tell us more about these events and what you think might cause them?
The patients really describe this very well. They are transient, often stereotypied, focal CNS dysfunction with complete recovery episodes. Most of them are, more commonly, are negative in nature, with sensory loss, focal motor deficit, or dysphagia. It was very similar to a transient ischemic attack, some with migraine afterwards. And others can have what we call positive symptoms, such as paresthesias that following Jacksonian march, limb jerking, non-formed visual hallucinations resembling seizures or migraine with auras. These episodes start on average about 15 years of the peripheral disease onset. And what we see is that they increase over time. The pathophysiology is not clear. They may well, in fact, represent true seizures, some of these episodes, or cortical spreading depression, as you see in some migraine studies. And as I told you before, we saw on postmortem studies early on that we see pathology going through the leptomeninges to vessels that can lead to ischemia or hemorrhage, including the so-called subarachnoid hemorrhage, similar to what we see in some amyloid spells of A-beta amyloidosis.
Yes, it's interesting, of course, that these same sort of events, so-called amyloid spells, happen with amyloid beta cerebral angiopathy. Are these spells similar between that disorder and hATTR related CNS disease? Are they different? And what do those similarities or differences imply for the different disorders and our recognition and treatment of them?
Actually, we don't have a really definite conclusion regarding that. We believe that the phenomenology, there are in the phenomenology terms of it, there are no major differences between the two of them. The descriptions are quite similar between the two populations. But of course, once we start to having a really more definitive and delicate analysis of all these patients, because even in TTR amyloidosis, there is a heterogeneous group of patients, even from genetic point of view, or from the age of onset and the specific topographic involvement. So I believe that probably we'll pick up some specific symptomatology, but in broader terms, we believe that there are no major differences, which actually put some mechanisms between these two disorders in the same pathways. That also is also exciting when you're thinking about treatment options.
So you brought this up earlier, and I understand the fact that these exciting molecular therapies are actually allowing us to follow patients long enough to see these clinical manifestations, but that the way we use these molecular therapies now isn't going to be effective because they don't cross the blood-brain barrier. What sorts of treatment options do you see on the horizon? Is there work in animal models, for instance, that inform how we might go about treating these patients in the future?
Yeah, unfortunately, as I told before, the available compounds do not seem to work on CNS. There are some studies also on in vivo gene editing, using strategies, doing things like knockout gene, but there is, even the role of TTR on CNS is not particularly well known, and there is some studies reflecting some protection of TTR, the protection role in CNS. So knockout of the gene can get that, has been proposed recently. New England paper has this difficulty to know what is happening. Also, the possibilities to anti-amyloid therapies that have been trying for the last 20 years to A-beta. We don't know if some of these techniques or strategies could be applied to TTR CNS amyloidosis. We currently do not know in detail what is the full spectrum of this CNS involvement on TTR amyloidosis. So taking this lesson from Corinne d'Andrade that described the first patients from the clinical grounds, I think it's really of paramount importance to go back and really characterize systematically this group of patients to be really sure what we are developing, even from clinical biomarkers, but also from when you are testing new treatments.
Wow, what a great answer. I always tell our students and residents that in diagnosis, the way you arrive at the right place is by just listening to the patient, and that's how we figure out what's going wrong. But I also tell them that our discovery of new therapies is founded in clinical phenomenology and careful clinical observations, and your answer is really affirming in that regard. I want to thank you for really a fantastic paper, and I hope everyone listening has the opportunity to go through and read it and think about it. And thanks so much for a fascinating podcast discussion with me today. I encourage everyone to check out the paper in Neurology and look forward to learning more about this over the years to come.
Thank you. It was a really pleasure to be with you today.
This is Jose Merino. Please remember that we offer free CME for each eligible podcast. simply find the episode online and click on the CME quiz link. We offer up to 60 hours of CME for past shows, and all are available online. It's free for AAN members. Be sure to check out this week's journal, which celebrates the 70th anniversary of neurology. It includes a special editorial and a timeline that describes key moments in the history of the journal, as well as an essay by Dr. Orly Avitzer, president of the AAN, where she describes how AAN publications have shaped her writing career. Happy anniversary, Neurology. Thank you again for listening, and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.